Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I've had Terrence McKenna on the brain of late, partly I'll be giving a talk about him later on at a religious studies conference in a couple of months, and I am doing some work on him for my PhD project. But more recently, I took part in a lovely little gathering here in San Francisco where some Terrence McKenna heads and fellow travelers got together and swapped stories and videos. And it was a wonderful scene. It reminded me of how much, a thinker and a entertainer, even if he's been gone over a decade now, can still bring people together. And one of the people who participated in the evening is our guest today, Ken Adams, who is a multimedia and video designer, as well as a poet, psychonaut, and all-around excellent character. And he just released a new movie, Imaginatrix, The Terrence McKenna Experience, which he used some of some footage from a variety of Terrence talks and twisted them into a marvelous mind-expanding Zowie ride with his very interesting style of weaving together multiple images into kaleidoscopic assemblages, giving us a kind of fresher take on a lot of kind of psychedelic visuals than what you normally see, and we'll be talking about some of that. And then I have also been the last day or so catching up with Tao Lin's, I think, rather charming series on Vice, the Tao of Terrence, which is has many, I think it's got 8 or 10 segments as of late, the latest one being Cannabis, the central practice of Terrence McKenna's life, which I believe is actually a true statement, not only that Terrence himself would say, but it's an important thing to recognize that while Mr. McKenna is associated most intimately with DMT and the psilocybin mushroom, that in many ways I think cannabis is the maybe not so secret key into his still inspiring, marvelous, consternating, and sometimes just ridiculous stream of concepts, poetic notions, possibilities, and jokes. So I look forward to talking about that with Ken. But before that, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, so Maja and I participated in an event last weekend in Los Angeles. It was a slow metal yoga followed by the Oneironauticum, which is a sort of a slumber party for dreamers, during which we listened to a piece of music that was hopefully going to inspire dreaming all night long. How did you find this, our little event of consciousness exploration?
It was totally fun. I love doing those things. Like I told you before, I tried one as well, and it never ceases to amaze me when you get a group of people all to try to dream together about, you know, either some specific topic or just trying to even dream in unison. I mean, it works. It just totally works. You know?
And there's something really intimate, too, just about sleeping in a room with people, some of whom you don't know, even some strangers. It's a very strange thing. I mean, it's a kind of a marvelous, a subtle way to be with other people in a way that we're really not used to, that is has its own special magic, regardless of whether or not people's dreams are affected.
Yeah, it's really funny. You know, there's these very severe boundaries. You can hang out with people during the day, like we all hang out together in public all day long, but at nighttime, no hanging out at nighttime. When you're sleeping, like, that's only reserved for people you love or are having sex with or are intimate with, you know. We don't usually think about just kind of sleeping with strangers.
Yeah, and I think it's also partly about silence. You know, it's like, you know, there's always that place you get to with friends or even lovers where, you know, you're hanging out and just for whatever reason there's like a silence and it just keeps going. And you realize that it makes you a little awkward. You feel a little unsure, but, you know, you kind of know you've crossed a certain point in the intimacy and the long, especially the kind of longevity of a relationship, when you really can just be silent with one another for, you know, half an hour or whatever it is. And there's something of that too, like at the end of the night you say good night John boy, good night, and then you're like, I am silent in a room with other people,
and now it is no talking time. It's that transition, you know, it's like, yeah, we're all these, you know, people and our identities, but then after the good night, everyone just kind of goes into crazy town and does their thing. So it is. It's weird to do that in silence with other people.
Yeah, because sleeping is sort of a withdrawal of identity. I went through this period, 15 years ago or something, when I don't know why, what was happening that I became very sensitive to this, but, you know, I would get in bed at night with my wife and then, you know, she would go to sleep, and I was having trouble going to sleep. And I was, mm-hmm. I'd go through this moment where I go, oh, my God, she's not here anymore. It's like, I can look at her body, but she's not here. I mean, I know I can, like, you know, knock her and then she'll become her identity again. And I even did that a few times until she was like, stop it. I'm trying to sleep.
No, it's weird. I remember when I went to Thailand on the plane, I can't sleep on planes. So there was this moment when the entire plane was asleep except for me. And I had that moment you're talking about with your wife, with all these strangers on a plane. I was like, I'm the only conscious awareness in this metal tube and everyone's sleeping all around me. It was really, really strange. It was an existential crisis.
Yeah, it's a funny one how it's so routine and yet there's still something kind of marvelous and bizarre about that. Well, speaking of marvelous and bizarre liminal states, let's move on to the topic of Terrence McKenna and other matters, and welcome Ken Adams to the show. Hey, Ken, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Oh, I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, and congratulations on the movie. You know, I know you've been working on it for a while, and, you know, I'd love to also hear about, you know, part of your process in deciding to make this, you know, having done work with Terrence and known him and been a very good friend of his. And, you know, worked with him back in the early 90s and, you know, another era of multimedia and technology and then coming around to doing something again with him. So what was it that this brought you to deciding to make another film expression of the Terrence McKenna experience?
Well, it was a series of things, and you can start the thread anywhere from, 9 years old to about 3 years ago, and it all has to do with having this sense of devotion as part of a cohort of people that saw the planet and our culture in some kind of crisis very early, from the first atomic bomb warnings and fallout shelters in our childhood. We recognized that something dramatic would have to happen to redirect all this energy toward more peace and loving and the things that were possible on this planet. And
well, what was your 9-year-old experience?
I was watching the John F. Kennedy presentation about the Cuban Missile Crisis, a prepared speech about putting everything on high alert and preparing for an atomic war, as they called it back then. And as I watched it, I had this realization that was something like realizing not only do we have something very wrong, but we've created these gigantic apparatuses of destruction that are threatening our own existence. And that seemed like suicidal. And I realized this isn't a personal problem. It's not who's president. It's not me. It's not dad. This is something to do with culture. I didn't even know the word culture yet, but I could see that something was wrong and would have to be addressed by people with fresh minds, because the old people saw it as perfectly rational to be led to this point of new annihilation for something to do with politics that 9-year-olds didn't think was that important.
That's right. So, do you feel like that's that sort of spirit was a lot of what motivated, you know, the whole. I mean, anyway, it's kind of a kind of a generic thing to say that it, that that some sense of that motivated a lot of the counterculture. But that was, you know, something that happened a long time ago, and of course, it shaped McKinnon as well as it shaped you and shaped me, even though I came, you know, a little late to the party. But at the same time, you know, a lot of things didn't happen through the sort of explosion of, you know, peace, love, and hedonism, and electronic machines, and personal computers, and all the things that kind of come out of that sort of consciousness revolution. But, you know, it's really not till the 80s, 90s, you know, the aughts that Terrence, you know, starts to make a impact on people's discussions, and, you know, you yourself also come to make more public art about these ideas. So how do you, like, trace this need for a renewed view of the world, of re-enchantment of the world, a re-inspiration through the kind of, you know, wreckage of the counterculture?
Well, that's exactly where I met Terrence, was in the middle of the wreckage of it, and it was a very crazy time. There wasn't a lot of confidence that the psychedelic thing would even keep moving. Would it even survive? And most professionals had been forced underground or doing things on the side, and were trying to figure out how to just keep the conversation going, even if it was whispering. But in pop culture, there was a handful of people that devoted themselves to keeping it going, and I had migrated into the art world, and I found Terrence on a radio program at an organic grocery store talking about psychedelia from a very positive point of view. I had read some of his stuff, but I'd never heard his voice before. And when I heard his voice, I was just like, oh, my God, who is this character? And how far is he going to go with this? Because he was just fully out of the closet while everybody else was basically whispering, except for a handful of people. So I got a computer at that point. I was an artist. I wrote a grant for the NEA. I got an experimental media grant. I bought an Amiga computer that could do video and color on the screen and all this stuff that was very fresh and new then, but that it was obvious to both myself and McKenna and my partner Britt Willeen that there would be huge jumps in the ability to convey visual information, visual languaging, in a very short period of time, and it'd be very opportune and strategically valuable to be representing the psychedelic position early in that discussion and seeing how it mapped into computer graphics and the development of 3D and the development of just image processing along, which we take.
Well, let's stay on this point a lot, because I think it's a really key one. It reminds me of one thing that Terrence said about the beginnings of the 20th century. Began with the move towards the moving image, and he had three examples of the moving image as a sort of new form at the beginning of the 20th century. It was Freud's attention to dreams as part of, you know, our conversation about consciousness, the emergence of film and cinema and the moving image as a new medium, and finally the turn towards psychedelics with the early in the West with the you know, the look at mescaline and the form constants. And all these things do actually cluster around the same time. And so this notion of both the moving image as a site of experience, knowledge, expression, information, and also the connection between our internal experience of the moving image, whether it is in dreams or in reverie or in the inner empiricism that arises with psychedelics, and the connection between that and media, and that there's some kind of larger loop that's going on, and that the period that you're talking about, which I'd like to, you know, spend a little bit of time with, maybe even have you talk a little bit more about the emergence of multimedia in a context where the handoff from an earlier psychedelic counterculture to an emerging technological, much more mediated, even more mediated, digitally mediated culture was something that really had to happen. It was like it didn't just happen naturally. It was people making decisions about moving in there, and particularly Terrence is right there, right at that hinge point, right with the emergence of rave and this kind of idea of a sort of digital re-expression of countercultural sensibility, but it was also something that really had to happen technologically as well. So talk a little bit about what was that multimedia scene like in the late 80s and the early 90s? What did it feel like working with these tools? What did you sense about how the implications of this stuff might be?
It was extremely exciting, and you know, people treated the first taste of digital media the same way we reacted to the first taste of psychedelics in popular culture. We saw the potential immediately within a certain cohort of the counterculture, and it was a very healthy, very active, right away, instant community, like a supersaturated solution. As soon as you could start making pictures and sound and eventually videos on a digital platform, people saw the potential to do all sorts of stuff, and they wanted to know how to do it, and they would have to teach themselves. So that was a lot like psychedelics for a lot of people in the 70s especially. There was all this interest, but there was no lineage. There were no structures of education that were worth having. There were people left on their own to talk to other teenagers down the street that looked like they were probably stoners too, and you whispered about what was in this little packet that got passed around, and it was basically a kind of an open source thing, but with very few people being able to provide information at a high quality level. With computers, that changed radically, and immediately you had the very first networks that existed, like the Well that you were very involved with. Immediately people sensed, oh my God, here's an uncensored platform for discussing things at a much more nuanced level. And McKenna saw that vividly. One of the things that makes him more popular now than when he was alive was that he encouraged everybody to tape or video everything he did. And he encouraged people to have this extreme radical sense of entitlement to spread those ideas around the world wherever they would go. So from 14 years after he's died, there's more interest in McKenna now than there ever has been, primarily because of YouTube and the internet providing uncountable numbers of uploads from people that are fascinated by what he's done.
Wow, I never really thought about that. In a way, he took a strand of the kind of, the Grateful Dead model of making the live recordings very available. And so now he has sort of he has this kind of permanent echoing voice in the archive. And it's an interesting phenomenon because as someone who, I don't remember, when did you meet McKenna?
1988.
Yeah. So I met him a few years later. And, such a heady time, so many interesting things happening, and we've already touched on a number of them. And watching your recent film, I mean, it was really wonderful on a number of levels, but just in terms of the raps that you selected to represent McKenna or to, represent aspects of his thought, and you have these different kind of categories, which I think do a good job of covering just some of the wide number of topics that he would address. That seeing it was really kind of interesting for me because I hadn't really listened to him or seen videos of him for many, many years. And what was odd was like how fresh the ideas were, but also how much I could hear them being of that particular time of the late 80s, the early 90s, the mid 90s. And so it was like a weird parallax because it's not like they seemed dated, but I could also see the way they had a sort of exuberance and a kind of wide angle that I think today is a lot harder to pull off. Like it's much, the wide angle is much more treacherous these days, and it's harder. There was a certain millennialist buzz to his rap, a sense of the bizarre wonders just around the corner that I think in our time now is increasingly bleak and shadowed with more ominous threats, and that he was able to keep open a sense of possibility that was not Pollyannish exactly. Sometimes he was pretty techno-utopian, but a lot of the times it was more like, whoa, here we go, people, you know. It was kind of a mixture of feelings. So I'd like to hear you as you went through, and, you know, you were also going through these older videos, and I know that you also hadn't really looked at his material for a long time. As you were kind of bringing these ideas forward now, how do you see his role now in terms of either specific ideas or the way he approached ideas? What is it that resonates with people now?
Wow. Well, I think he's in a sense become his own meme. And I think that anybody that cares enough about psychedelics to have read a book in the last 5 years about it or gone online and searched about it probably has some connection with that meme, and that people understand it in its historical context to some extent. But I think part of what I tried to address in the movie is exactly about that issue. The way I had a complicated role to play, because this wasn't like, these were all private recordings between me and Terrence and my partner, Britt Willeen. We would do them in an alchemical kind of situation where it would take hours of preparation to get everything to work. And then we would race off into this other world filming, taping, while we could. And then it would disappear and everything would crash down and you'd be done with that. So there was this incredible perseverance just to grab snatches of Terrence while we were actually doing these experiments. So I tried to devise a technique that would show this kind of varying viscosity of the information we're seeing. Sometimes McKenna is shown in these original low-res clips, and he's contained in an old beat-up television that's very similar to the one Terrence owned when I knew him, when I first met him, and I went to show him some of my videos, and he played them back on this TV that was so pathetically bad that you couldn't tell it was a real color TV. It didn't look color anymore, it just looked broken. And I said, we're going to have to get him another TV and stuff, and he goes, why? I never watch TV. So he was both super techie, but he was also almost reactionary, like a Grateful Dead position on television of, like, absolutely the less is the better and that kind of stuff. So I think it was a great opening for him to see the digital thing spreading out in front of him. So I tried to deal with that by portraying his image in the movie in different contexts. He starts off in this dilapidated TV. At some point, he's in this science fiction-y TV that's kind of Walt Disney-ish. And in the ending, he's inside of an iPad-type tablet conveyance. Because it's bizarre to hear him talking about some of this stuff from 1989 that's still about as fresh as you can get in understanding what the implications of the Internet are, and what an unguarded secret it is that this incredible power of information between peers will cause a renaissance, is causing a renaissance, an awakening that will help us to balance against all this darkness and life-threatening, cultural-threatening conundrum our whole world is in, our planet has found itself in. That's definitely what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and so here's another, I mean, he's a very complicated person. I mean, in a way, you know, I think you kind of have to be a complicated person to, expose all of these ideas and practices and experiences in a public light. I mean, it's a very strange thing. Even as he remained private in some ways, it's not like he was there for all to see. And I think one of the axes that I was never clear on, and I'd like to have you clarify how you saw it, is precisely his kind of optimism-pessimism line. I mean, sometimes he would present very bleak pictures of the nature of the world. He was very angry in a political way, like not in just a random, off-the-handle way, but he had a very coherent, clearly identified set of things he was very angry about and had been since he was a radical. And it's really important to remember, we've talked about this, that when he was at Berkeley in the 60s, he wasn't just a hippie. He was also a radical. He was a politically engaged, angry, anarchist guy who wanted to tear the system down. And he never really lost that side of it. And so now, and I, the reason I ask about this question of optimism and pessimism is because now we can see that while the elements in the internet and the elements of digital culture that he was promoting and that you've been talking about are clearly still part of the picture, peer-to-peer, visionary displays of information, networked mind, the archive of the mysteries available, allowing people to plug into different forms of enchantment or insight, et cetera, et cetera, that while that's going on, of course, there's all this other stuff going on, just even in terms of the internet, let alone the world stage. And so it can be tough to keep that optimism going. And I'm kind of just curious, like, how do you think he would see it now?
Okay, this I'll try to tie a couple of things in back to marijuana. One of the things that I think that Terrence really understood and valued was the social health element of smoking marijuana and attracting people into conversations. I was recently at an event, a private psychedelic-inspired event, where the fire hazard was so high that they had to restrict people smoking to these tiny little zones where it was safe, where it was gravel and there wasn't brush around. And consequently, instead of people roaming around smoking, everybody had to come to these little cones of smoke to do their thing, and ended up people would just stay there and sit there, and other people came to sat. And we had the most interesting and invigorated conversations of the whole event in those little zones. So Terrence loved to smoke pot with interesting people more than just about anything. And at the end of his life, and at the last parts of his life where he had to be responsible for a family and have a public-leaning persona, that was a huge part of his contact back to the world, was sit, smoke pot, talk, laugh, get relaxed, be a trickster, be funny, make a fool of yourself, and eventually open up to these very fertile realms of the imagination that we could share linguistically and in the felt presence of each other's human existence. We were there and we could share these ideas. And it was quite wonderful. I'm sure you spent hours doing this with Terrence. And to me, that's part of the thing that we want to save from that whole thing. He loved to sit as a daily discipline and have interesting conversation and speculation about how optimistic he was and about how much despair he could carry. I saw him deliver the most intense pro-anarchist, psychedelic, political rage I've ever seen at Stanford University during a conference, and it's basically been sat on and never released because it was too inflammatory. The guy had a really angry revolutionary spirit. But I think the key to getting the measure on him is the way he dealt with reality and knowledge and being so mysterious that he didn't really have belief. He didn't really have doctrine. He didn't really put his mark in the sand and say, we've got this far to go or we're going to fall over. He knew that the whole thing was so much more chaotic and infinitely more complex than his mind, brain, body, and spirit could comprehend while still in a human container, and being able to language anything about it was very limited. So he really had this open-ended kind of faith that the cosmos itself is this supersaturated opportunity that it has intrinsic to it is life and consciousness. And
yeah, I want you to connect those two things, which is that there's something about the conversation, the dialogue, the expanded dialogue, the stimulated dialogue of possibilities, humor, the kind of space that opens up is not just a space to enjoy other people or to enjoy being high or to enjoy language or to enjoy thinking, although it's all of those. I think that the devotion to conversation, and this is part of the reason that motivates this whole show, But the devotion to conversation is also an ontology. It's also a relationship to the future. It's also a relationship to the cosmos. And I think so. I think those two elements in him went together, that even though he was angry and could be very dark about how he saw the world, that the gesture you make in conversation, the gesture of openness towards the other, the ball is always in flight, and it can be funny, and it can be human, and it can be terrifying, but it's always moving forward in an open-ended way among people. That I think really ties together those things, because there's always that gesture towards possibility. There's always the openness towards the other.
Part of his exercise, it was almost an etiquette, and I'm sure you saw him do this, but sometimes somebody would say something that on the face of it seemed absurd and silly, and somehow I would see Terrence turn it in either an amusing way or some entirely bizarre speculative way that just might barely make sense, in order for the person to save face and go away thinking they said something either funny or intriguing or even possibly important. And I saw people walk away from that feeling, wow, I feel inspired. I can think through these things. I can have these experiences with people that have broad experience and walk away from it feeling acknowledged and pursue whatever version of that is in my life as much as I call to.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, we have to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking with Ken Adams about Terrence McKenna, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maj Daou. Here with my co-host, Eric Davis, and we are speaking with Ken Adams today. And his new movie about Terrence McKenna should be pretty fantastic. And before the break, we were speaking about, you know, some of Terrence's abilities to hold those spaces open instead of like the shutdown, which a lot of people get kind of all over the place. He, I felt like, was very dedicated in every single situation or arena he was in to keep everything, like you said, like it would be loosey-goosey, right? He would kind of like flip stuff and move it and switch it. And it's funny because very much when I think of Terrence McKenna, I think above all else, the idea of freedom. I know, as you mentioned, he was a revolutionary and a rebel, but I felt like a lot of what he was doing was trying to get people to just, you know, consider those potentials or possibilities, or, you know, instead of like revolutionary, maybe more like for him, it was about just breaking every possible paradigm that you could put onto something. So do you feel like in your going through his work and looking at his movies and seeing how he would hold those spaces, like you said, of those open dialogues, those open conversations, contributing to places on the internet where it was open source stuff, just those ideas of having all things available, even if some of them were incorrect, right? So, like, a lot of people will razz the McKenna stuff because they're like, oh, he's just speculating, he doesn't know, he's just talking out of whatever, but you know, part of that component, as you guys have mentioned before, was about just expanding it to see, like, well, what all do we have available here in that very kind of trickstery way. Did you see, like, going through his stuff, a kind of underlying theme of those types of, like, freedom, like, just straight that kind of ability to run wild, to do anything possible?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting and fascinating things about him is how come this skinny guy from Colorado came out of cowboy land with so much courage and perseverance and just vigor to just take things on. It's funny. But, you know, there's a lot in that question because he is a complicated guy. And just for a moment, let's stop and think about this. Terrence had to live with himself.
Yeah.
Terrence thought a lot about who Terrence is. What
right.
the hell happened to cause Terrence to be Terrence?
Right.
And part of it, I think, is this forcing yourself to live by your wits, when you're a smart, scrawny kid around a bunch of bullies in a you know, pretty tense environment or for whatever reasons, if you escape terror by being funny, I know this from experience. I was a really small kid in Shreveport, Louisiana, and there were racists everywhere, and I had black friends. And I found that if I could be funny and adopt some point of view that they would recognize as funny and present it like a theatrical act, they'd let me wiggle out of it, move on.
Right.
It would immediately change the context of the confrontation. Instead of being a villain, a victim, I was entertaining them and also probably doing something that was slightly challenging but not in any dangerous way,
right,
by being funny. And McKenna talks about that some, and I still don't have much to go on, though, about why McKenna even happens. In his own eyes, you know, it was a template waiting to be played. You have to have the first, you know, you're playing solitaire with the universe, you turn the first card. He was available, had enough stuff in place to occupy the information. But at another level, he knew there was something else very bizarre going on and that he didn't pretend to grasp it. He didn't have
a lineage.
Yeah,
I think it's very interesting because I do. I feel like it's almost like his consciousness was, like, too big for the situation. Like you said, right, he has this scrawny little frame that his big consciousness is, like, stuck into in an area of the earth that is just, you know, kind of not very conducive to its expanding. So it's true, like, what makes those people? Like, a lot of times you'd think it'd be some terrible environment, like slavery, or they have to, like, come up against some serious force. And it's almost like for him, that force was his own consciousness itself.
Yeah, I think it was like his horse. For cowboys, we underestimate that whole mythology of being able to get on your horse and ride out of town and go have adventure and maybe meet some beautiful women that know about peyote or something. I don't know what it was, but he really saw himself as being on a peculiar journey. And when people say he was just speculating, the word just is always diminutive and unfair when it's usually used, and it's, he was a great speculator. He was
incredible. I'm like, just, what does anyone do? We're all just speculating. Nobody knows anything. Like, what do scientists do, right? It's so, it's really dismissive.
Yeah, and we're curating our own realities every moment. One of the things I love to do in this movie, the approach of, I took about some of the visual languaging was to flood the screen over full with thousands of images at different times, at different layers on different X, Y, and Z axes, and make this conundrum for the attention to see something it's never seen before. Hundreds of moving images in different 3D spaces seen from a point of view which itself is fluid. So it forces you to choose from all these things going on what to notice, to pay attention to. Do I sink into a soft focus kind of Taoist mode where I'm just softly watching the whole being roll out? Or do I follow these different threads visually, this corner to that, to this image? And I think psychedelics are very much like that. Even when we're not aware of it, we're curating our experiences up to a point where you do finally jump off the abyss and go off into that other realm, which is infinity and out of anyone's control.
The visual language that you've developed is really, you know, unusual, and it's kind of funny seeing it because I'm like, how come I don't see more stuff like this? I mean, I remember when I was first thinking, you know, that at the same time I met Terrence and in the early 90s and thinking about things that would become Technosis, that, you know, the one of the things that was going to happen were these elaborate associational links and networks. You know, the idea of the glass bead game, to go back to Hermann Hesse, and that was a very important inspiration for Timothy Leary back in the 60s when he was thinking about a way to understand psychedelic cognition in a non-mystical way, like to not invoke straight religious ideas, but to say, no, it's kind of a cognitive game, but it's a game of these associations of art and time and emotions and memory and icons, and, you know, it was sort of like a game played with all of the archive of human culture and consciousness. And, you know, I just thought I would see so much more of that because in some ways we have that because of course, we're always curating our experience online, and there's hyperlinks, and everything is surrounded by everything else, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of standalone works that aren't just barraging you with too much information, but creating environments where you're sort of invited to recognize how we move through the archive now, taking a bit from here, taking a bit from there, building these gossamer webs of association that then sort of fold or break apart as new bits come in. It still seems like there's a lot to do with that kind of approach to filmmaking, to organizing, to curating environments. So I'd love to hear you riff on that kind of multimedia as a model of the world perspective.
Yeah, I try to use the production tools now for what they allow us to do that we couldn't before. I try to expand on those elements that have a natural kind of correlation of computer graphics with psychedelic idioms and modalities that everybody understands, like kaleidoscopes, if you want to, or spirals, or deformations of scale in very short time. So I try to do all that because I can see that it's causing myself to have these other experiences that are not locked into the point of view of a camera, where you have a director saying, look at this, and limiting and framing the implications very dramatically, but what's on screen? I'm trying to blast out of that myself. One of the heroes of that is George Lucas. I saw this early interview where he had this aha moment that he was flipping out about, where he had been in front of some computer graphic demo with some of his people, and he suddenly realized that not only do you have the freedom to move with a computer-generated ecology of space, you can move in X, Y, Z. Yeah, you can move your camera around anywhere you want at any point of view, but every object has its own X, Y, Z and its own center, and that when you disassociate those, you have a space no one's ever seen. It's not the photographic illusion that happens when you point a camera and there's horizon and there's depth of field and all that stuff. It's something entirely new that comes from digital capacity. It's something no one would have even thought of exploring until now. So I do a lot of work in this virtual field that every object can be in its own space and become its own focus. Like in DMT, sometimes in DMT I'm in a similar world where at a much more elegant, beautiful, and mysterious way, I can feel that there are all these imaginal quantum units, and any one of them, if I give it my attention, can blossom out into a self-created reality or poem or smell or imagined relationship. Anything possible to experience as a human and for beyond can be contained in any one imaginal cell of this quantum stuff that you can see on DMT and that is very persistent in the reports people have. I think we're on the verge of seeing new information in groups. I think that's going to be interesting. When we start seeing this stuff together more coherently, that might be a launch pad into all sorts of opportunities.
Well, do you know, like in your work with it, did you ever come across any groups that like did some of those things together, like any McKenna kind of like groupies that would get together and do any experiments like that you knew about?
Oh, I know quite a few groups. I've been exposed or, introduced to quite a few groups that do DMT as part of their ceremonial practice. I haven't met any psychedelic fanatics in my own life. I meet people that are kind of enthusiastic about them online, but my circles, it's kind of like, well, he's taken for granted kind of as a prologue to the discussion, but he's not like nobody that knew Terrence thinks he was a saint or anything supernatural in that regard. There was a bunch of strange psychosocial historical convergences in his story, but he didn't pretend to be any kind of sacred being or anything like that any more than you are or I am or anyone
right.
Listening to him or us. So I don't really run into that. I run into people that want to get rid of McKenna because they say he's just full of blarney, and I remind them that blarney is an important part of culture, and that he definitely did Blarney like world class, but he also did a lot of other stuff, and to limit him to that part of his offering is to
right.
misunderstand things.
I think it's also important to emphasize that there were many general consistencies about his perspective as well, is that even though he was riffing, this might be the case, this might be the case, it could be this, it could be that, there were certain themes that he would come back to over and over again, and some of them accord reasonably well with a modern perspective of based on science and empiricism and technology and the freedom of thought. And in some ways he was very keyed with that, but in other ways he was also a thinker from another time, not just a deeply Gutenberg thinker, someone who thinks in terms of books and literature more than in terms of new media, although he was very prophetic about the latter. But even older than that, as a hermeticist, as someone who still has within him an idea of the soul, of transcendence, even of the transcendence of matter, that put him not only out of the running vis-a-vis a lot of modern materialist thinkers, but even in contrast with a lot of New Age fellow travelers. And so he was very he had a very interesting angle on some of these very old, much older ideas about the spirit. And I know that in your documentary you have a section or two, really, but definitely one section where you kind of show his own link to the history of hermeticism, of alchemy and magical thought within the West, and this peculiar way that he brought that into a scientific, technological, science fictional world of virtual reality and those matters. So in some ways he was kind of a religious thinker, but without the sort of framework of religion. And it's not always clear to me how much that comes through for people who are just going, wow, cool, he's talking about monkeys and mushrooms and UFOs and da-da-da-da. But he really had a kind of a deep vision that also very much had a strong sense about where we're going involved in it.
Yeah, I think he was as in love with alchemy as you can get without being somebody that others call an alchemist. He definitely gave us this sense that he believed in the idea that there was a mystery to every individual human spirit that could be explored and discovered, and psychedelics were a part of a viable way to be there, to find that and to discover that in oneself. And I think he was probably more fascinated as an intellectual with alchemy than any other single subject. He also saw this kind of connection between that I think Walter Benjamin has and the whole hermeneutic tradition of understanding that language somehow both constructs our possibilities, but also allows us to subtly create amnesia where we let go of realities, where we let go of pain too big to mess with, or we transform it by letting it go through some decay stage into some baser metal and transform. But we see that he thought that at the center of all that was the access to the human mind and heart through psychoactive substances, and that he saw the whole thing as a psychedelic alchemical metaphor. Everything from the Rosicrucians to the end of history. So when you introduce the Rosicrucians to this, it lifts my heart, because he loved the Rosicrucian story, and many times, we discussed the whole 2012 scenario in terms of a project like the Rosicrucian manifestos that could be enigmatic enough to hold a secret that would be, by design, unsolvable, mysterious, an enigma, in a word, and that would allow people to focus their intentions and their fears and their hopes of consequences of a planetary nature around the possibility that something mega dramatic is going to happen on this date in 2012. And I used to rag him about it and say, I want to do a festival called 2013 where I have people do, you know, speculative psychedelic visions about what it's going to be like in 2013. And he would joke and say he would probably retire in 2013, and I was welcome to it. Go at it. So,
it's pretty funny.
But it is a very ingenious level project, that 2012 thing. And it's not to say that he didn't have non-rationalist, mystical, resonance that would make him want to believe these things in some sense. But he also understood the value of taking something like the shift in history that 2000 wanted to be but really couldn't be because it was oversaturated. But he knew 2012 was hanging in there as an apocalyptic data point for Mayans and for the I Ching. If you stick it at the right spot in history, it maps right up, you know.
Well, and I mean, this is what's funny, is everyone kind of, like, poo-poos all the 2012 stuff, but, like, look at the planet Earth presently. Like, I know, yeah, messed up stuff happens all the time, but so maybe it wasn't exactly 2012 that everything ended, but certainly if you look at the political status of most countries and kind of the energy present, it seems a little more than usual. So interestingly enough, even though there was that kind of wah-wah on the 2012 date itself, you can't deny that consciousness is currently having an overhaul, like kind of on a global level just with the revolution. So it's kind of interesting just to see, you know, that whole thing as well.
Yeah, I don't think that the exact day is just a pivot event, but think how many people were looking to the skies, tripping, making love,
right,
out in the woods, out in the desert, out in the mountains. There are children that are born that were conceived that night that are going to be named Terrence or Dayglow or Moongarden.
True.
And those kids have consequence, too. Back to the pessimism ratio, I mean, behind a lot of this is discussions Eric and I had recently, and we're both sensitive to the situation in the Middle East from interests we have and friends we have and how dark that has gotten. I think it's important to have faith in a bigger mystery than my brain can put around it, and it takes a lot of work to do this for me. And it involves grieving, and it involves celebration with my friends. It involves going to Burning Man if I can, walking around a temple of grief, crying for an hour, helping other people while they're wailing in the dust. There's all these things we're inventing to deal with this soul-torturing grief of our planet, and not just our planet, but our people. We know we're really close. We're on a planet so near to paradise. We're so near in some ways, and it's being trashed and trashed and trashed. So I pray to the angels that listen to my tunes that somehow we learn to remember and love and respect the planet as she deserves, and that the faster we can get that part of the equation going with as much force, then the better our chances are.
Well, what is the way, like, we just got a couple of minutes left, and I love that gesture both towards the larger mystery and towards the difficult work of the heart that's necessary just to even keep your eyes open and to acknowledge grief but not be completely trapped in the difficulties now. But it's also the case that things are shifting in the world of Burning Man, the world of psychedelics. Things are closer to the mainstream than ever before. You know, there's articles in the New York Times about all the tech elite going to Burning Man in this sort of weird kind of like a more of a mirror of our disequilibrated society than an alternative to it. And I think something is true. Some of that is true with psychedelics as well. So, again, we only have a couple of minutes, but I'd love to hear you sort of just riff a bit on how to not let this just become another commodified zone of experience, of trends, of hipness, that whole thing that goes along with popularity in our postmodern world, and to keep some of that edge going. How do we do that?
Well, I think it's a spectrum from Gold Rush to Mystery School and You and I are, by definition, in a mystery school because we read and write on a regular basis, and a lot of the people that are in our tribe will probably never read a serious book again in their lives. So I'm trying to see that as a place to meet them where they are, and that's on a rectangle of any size, from their pocket to a big old wall inside of a theater, that the rectangle is dominating how they're seeing the world. And I'll remind them to unplug, to love nature, to insist on being in nature. To me, it's a conundrum that I face every day in my own life. I think we are trying to solve these balances, and I'm hoping that the things I'm doing are good decisions, and I don't know if they are. I don't think we know that anymore. We've kind of lost that certainty, and we're having to be very creative. And my advice is to trust your heart and to guide your head with your heart, to trust friends. We need to make friends at a mass level, and we need to understand what that would imply, that we share, that we care for each other. We are going to either be a model of what's going to happen one way or the other. It's going to be a giant refugee camp in the desert, like a Burning Man feels like sometimes, or it'll be the rebirth of humanity in the desert, like Burning Man feels like sometimes.
Well, that's a beautiful note to end on. We got to wrap it up. Ken, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, it was a joy. Thank you guys so much.
And I want to point you all to terrence-mckenna-movie.tumblr.com to touch in with Ken's film, Imaginatrix. Very worthwhile. So from Majid and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.